You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Although the crisis at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant is far from over, people are already asking what the future might hold for the nuclear industry here and abroad, and what lessons we may have learned from the current disaster. Joining us now is Peter Bradford, a former member of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission and a vice chair of the Union of Concerned Scientists, and I'm very pleased to welcome you to our show.
Glad to be here.
Given what we know so far, do you think that this incident exposes any vulnerabilities at other nuclear power plants around the world that we should be concerned about?
I'm sure that it does. That is, there aren't many nuclear power plants anywhere that would have stood up to the forces that hit the Fukushima plant.
Because it was a double whammy, an earthquake and a tsunami.
It was a double whammy, but more fundamentally, in any regulatory system, the people in charge deem some types of events to be impossible or so unlikely that they don't have to be guarded against. And it doesn't have to be an earthquake and a tsunami. You know, it can be terrorism, can be sabotage beyond a certain level. And what's going to, I think, happen now is a sort of a forced rethinking of that process of deeming things to be impossible and therefore not guarding against them.
Well, there's an article in today's Times about the oldest of the reactors being quite old and haven't gotten through, gotten permission to continue despite the fact that there were cracks in the concrete and the like. What about the age of many of the reactors throughout the world? Is that something we should be concerned about? Are these things really built to last?
Well, they were licensed for 40 years in the U.S. originally, and that the number was more or less arbitrary. It wasn't based on a conclusion that they couldn't go beyond 40 or that they would necessarily last 40, and a number haven't. We've yet to really learn the role that aging has played in this accident, so I hesitate to draw any long-term conclusions. At the same time, it's hard not to take note that the four plants that have had the most trouble, four of the six at the site, are the four oldest.
Do you think that anything has gone well or even relatively well over the course of this incident?
You know, the Japanese caught one real break, and that was that the wind has primarily been offshore. So a great deal of the radioactivity that was released blew out over the ocean, and that held the public exposure and the land and vegetable exposures down somewhat.
What happens to the radiation that goes into the ocean? Does it just float across, or does it go in and affect all the sea life?
If it goes in from the air, it will be pretty widely dispersed, and more widely dispersed the further you get from shore. The more troublesome radiation is going to the ocean now is these large volumes of seawater that they're having to pump through to cool the plant, because it was never designed to be cooled that way for as long as it's going to have to be, and they've got ruptured fuel, so that water's going to be carrying a lot of radioisotopes back into the ocean, I think.
One of the major concerns over the last week has been the spent fuel in the Fukushima reactors. What makes spent fuel so problematic?
Well, that's the fuel that's been used in the reactor and taken out. So it contains a lot of radioisotopes, not as many as the fuel that's actually in the reactor, because some have decayed away.
But we're still talking about something with a very long half-life.
Yeah, I mean, this is the same stuff that we don't know how to dispose of. Remember the whole Yucca Mountain controversy and all. But for the early years after it's taken out of the reactor, it's also just so thermally hot that it has to be kept in water. Otherwise, it will heat up, cause the so-called the cladding, that is the metal on the outside, to oxidize, turn brittle, swell, burst. And all those things have happened in the course of this accident in the spent fuel pools.
Elizabeth Culbert points out in this week's New Yorker that more than two dozen reactors in the U.S. have above-ground storage pools similar to those that have failed at Fukushima. The only difference is that the American pools contain far more waste than their Japanese counterparts. Why did they have so much more waste in them?
The Japanese follow two policies that we don't. At Fukushima, they take some of the spent fuel out of the individual pools and put it in a large central pool. on the site. So there is a big spent fuel pool at that site.
Has that one also been losing water?
That one is not above the grade of it's not up in the reactor building, so it didn't undergo an explosion, and as far as I know, is still intact. And secondly, they take some fuel away to go through a process called reprocessing, which for other reasons I think is a big mistake, but it does get it off-site. The problem is it's more expensive. It creates fuel for nuclear weapons, and it doesn't help in any significant way with the long-term waste management.
For some critics of the nuclear power industry, the real problem is the spent fuel. You can build a plant that has all the safeguards possible, although even then there are problems possibly. But there's nothing you can do with the spent fuel. And we have, as you point out, the Obama administration has rejected burying spent fuel at the Yucca Mountain, although there was considerable resistance in Nevada and New Mexico to similar plants, weren't there? This is a kind of a NIMBY thing, and people don't even want the fuel to go through their states on their way to these repositories.
You know, it's the history of spent fuel is a really tortured episode. The government undertook a commitment to dispose of it, which it doesn't do for any other industry. That is, other industries have to get rid of their own wastes. But then it failed to deliver on that commitment. It spent a long time looking at Yucca Mountain, then it decided on Yucca Mountain, and now it's switched away from Yucca Mountain. So even though taking the fuel was an extraordinary favor to the industry in the first place, at this point in time, it's hard to see that the industry's benefited much from it.
Would any of this be possible if the United States government hadn't made it a lot easier to build these plants? Because initially, there was resistance. The insurance industry didn't want to insure them. They saw this as a real problem for them. And it was only the U.S. government and an act of Congress that backed up the insurance that allowed this to happen. So how much of this is really based on taxpayer money?
Well, the nuclear industry has always maintained that without the limitation of liability that you just mentioned, which is in the Price-Anderson Act that was passed in 1957, they would not build nuclear power plants. So that governmental action seems to have been essential, and the industry maintains it's still essential to the building of any more plants. The limit on liability now is in the range of $12 billion.
Well, we have the most nuclear power plants in the world, 104, I think it is.
That's right.
Second is France with 57. What does France do with its waste?
The French reprocess the waste, which means they take out plutonium and the uranium with the intent to reuse it. They don't actually reuse very much, but that still leaves all the other radioisotopes, the cesium and the iodine that we're hearing about now at Fukushima, but a great many others that have to be disposed of for equally long periods of time. So the French have waste from the reprocessing plants. We have waste from the power plants, and neither one of us know what to do about it.
My guest is Peter Bradford, a former member of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, now vice chair of the Union of Concerned Scientists. You worked at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in the aftermath of the Three Mile Island
incident. During and after, yes.
So following that incident, the accident, there was a requirement that an evacuation plan be drawn up for a 10-mile zone around the nuclear plants. I just read that the evacuation plans involved had residents moving in both directions across a narrow bridge, so they realized that those plans weren't very good. But even if the plans are good, there's a 10-mile zone around nuclear plants. Elizabeth Colbert says that in her article in The New Yorker that safely evacuating the 300,000 people who live 10 miles around the Indian Point plant is implausible. And there are 20 million people who live within 50 miles of that plant.
That's right.
Including you and me. Well, I don't know about you, but me.
Not me now. I did grow up within 50 miles of Indian Point. Yes, and that was one of the reasons that Governor Mario Cuomo opposed the opening of the Shoreham plant on Long Island, too. He couldn't see how Long Island could be evacuated in the event that something like what just happened in Japan happened there. Yeah, you know, there were no requirements for off-site evacuation plans when the U.S. plants, most of them, were sited. And as a result, the evacuation planning requirement has had to be backfitted to sites that, in some cases, it's very hard to imagine a fully effective evacuation.
There was a letter to the Times, not unexpected, which somebody pointed out that every source of energy has its problems. We have mining disasters and then all the pollution that comes from coal-fired plants. Of course, oil, petroleum has many, many problems attached to it. So the argument is this is just the same sort of thing. Why are we focusing on this one rather than all of them?
Well, first of all, I've yet to see an evacuation or other kind of emergency declared around energy efficiency or a wind or renewable energy site. But yes, it's certainly true that the other major energy sources all do have problems. That's really the primary reason that nuclear power has been able to continue to go forward, even though for many years it's been more expensive than coal and natural gas.
Is there anything that you would like to see being done with Indian Point or where you live in Vermont, where there's another very controversial plant? Indian Point is near a fault line, isn't it? Why would they even build a nuclear plant near a fault line?
Well, in many cases, they didn't know about the fault lines. I'm not sure that was true at Indian Point. Also, the first Indian Point plant, which is closed now, was quite small. As to some of the faults, they have assumed that they could design plants that would withstand the largest possible earthquake. And it's thought that the largest possible earthquake in most of the U.S. is quite a bit smaller than what we've just seen in Fukushima. It's not true of two plants in California, though.
But the Japanese were surprised by the strength
of
this
earthquake. Well, that's the thing. Yeah, I mean,
once in a century kind of experience. Who knows whether those two faults near Indian Point might at some point act up in that way?
And furthermore, because the plants that aren't in high seismic zones in the U.S. weren't designed to the highest possible levels, it doesn't take an earthquake of that magnitude to exceed their design basis. But of course, if you're far enough inland, you're not going to get a tsunami on top of it.
Before this accident, weren't people throwing around the phrase nuclear renaissance to describe shifting attitudes in favor of nuclear power? And prominent environmentalists, many had come out in favor of nuclear power over the last few years as a solution to climate change. Is that going to change completely, do you think?
It's clear already from some polling that's been done since the accident started that at least for the time being there's a significant shift in the public attitude away from nuclear power and toward efficiency, toward renewables. The nuclear renaissance was pretty much on the rocks anyway, though, because the new nuclear is so expensive relative to efficiency, renewables, natural gas.
You mean building the plant itself? And
building the very high capital costs. Fuel's not very expensive, but it's really the redundant safety systems, the big cooling towers that are very capital intensive, and it takes a long time.
And now China has rethought its nuclear program.
It's announced that it will not license further plants. I'm not clear as to whether they've stopped construction of any of the ones that are under construction.
A number of Japanese commentators have pointed out that there's a sad irony in the fact that the country that was most affected by nuclear power in the past is now going through this. You wonder whether people have learned from history.
That's an especially sad and ironic dimension that the country that experienced Hiroshima and Nagasaki is now going through this.
Peter Bradford is a former member of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, vice chair of the Union of Concerned Scientists. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me on.